It takes a lot of what?
Wadding. Wadding. Shoving.
Pushing.
Pushing, that's the same thing.
To, you mean pushing your memory?
Yeah.
Yeah, how about a little light? Well, when did you first come to Alaska?
1905.
You came up here in 1905?
Yeah.
And from where did you come?
From Chicago. I tell you, in 1902, I ran away from Germany. I ran away from a Benedictine monastery. They were going to make a monk out of me. But I couldn't see it. So I ran away. And I took a ship down the Rhine, got into Holland. And I fooled around in Holland for a week, tried to scheme how to get to England. I finally got it. I stowed away on a ship that went from Rotterdam to England, to London. Stowed away. They never even knew I was on board. When they come to London, everybody started to walk off, and so did I. I was 15 then. I had somebody had given me a sixpence, English money, something like a dime. And that's all the money I had. I spent all the money in Rotterdam until I got stowed away on this ship. I landed 5 o'clock in the evening in London, the biggest city in the world, and I couldn't talk a word of English, and I didn't know a soul in London. And only had this sixpence in my pocket. Well, I got ashore all right. But I didn't have no place to sleep or to eat. Because eating was out of question, it was late at night. So I went into on the dock, along the dock there was those vestibules from the warehouses. I went into one there and I seen, oh, there were barrels and all kinds of things. Anyhow, there was a box there, and there were hay in it. Something had been in it. So I crawled in there till morning, and it was one of those misty, wet mornings. So I started out. First, there was a bunch of street Arabs, you know, those kids. They knew I was a stranger. And they got around me. And they talking. I know if I open my mouth and say something in a strange language, they might beat me up. I know what the big city boys were. I was raised in them. So I made the Devendum sign, as if I didn't understand, couldn't talk. They finally walked away, looked at me. I could tell by the way they looked at me and got the impression what they were saying, oh, let the damn dummy alone, something like that. Then I walked from one street out into another looking for a German sign. Finally, I landed up on Oxford Street. That's in the Piccadilly Circus area, a wealthy part of the town. And there was a sign that said in German, German restaurant. High class place. I went in there. I was hungry. And when I got in the first, there was a doorman there with a fine big uniform on. He tried to grab me, but he wasn't fast enough. He went right into the dining room. And here was all those people in the heights of fashion, dressed men and women, and waiters, lots of waiters with heavy silver tray and waiting on the people. But I was watching where they come from. That was the pantry. So I went in the pantry. I didn't stay long in one place, just so I know my next move. When I got in the pantry, there was so much noise there, hollering orders and one thing another. So I seen another door. And I went in there, and there was fellas cutting meat. No, I didn't want that. I looked for another door, and I went in there. And here was a lady, a middle-aged lady, I imagine about 40, between 40 and 50. It was the salad pantry. And she was making salad, and there was a chair, and I sit on the chair, and she didn't even notice me first, and watching her. Funny, she looked, and evidently, she said, "Hello, sonny," something like that. But I said right away, "Oh, I don't speak English," in German. Oh, then she says, "How long have you been in London?" I said, "Since last night." She says, "Since last night?" This was about 10, must have been about 9 o'clock or so in the morning. And that was the people still eating breakfast. That was what they did. So she says, "Where do you come from?" I says, "When? Last night?" I says, "I come from the dock, from the ship." Well, she said, "Where did you sleep?" I says, "In one of the buildings on the dock." And she says, "Have you got any money?" "Yes." And I pulled out that sixpence. And she said, "That all you got?" "Yeah." And she laughed. She says, "What are you going to do?" "Oh," I says, "I'll get by and get to looking around first." She said, "Do you know anybody in London?" I said, "No." "You talk English?" "No." She says, "What a nerve you've got." I says, "Whatever that is, I guess it helps." So she said, "I got a friend in the West End, in the East End. You go there, a lady friend, I'll give you the address." So she wrote the address down. And I was way in the West End, and the East End quite a ways apart. And she had the name and address there, and she says, "You go there." Well, the only way I knew, I'd get outside, go to the end of a sidewalk, and watch for a policeman. And as soon as I seen one, I let him come close, and I run up to him, and I showed him that. He read it, and, "Oh yes, you go down this way, and down that, and turn that," and because I didn't understand nothing, I only watched his finger. And I thanked him, and I said, "Dankeschön," in German. And when I was at last again, I'd done the same thing again. And it took me 4 hours, but I made it. I don't know how many policemen I asked, but I just watched their finger. So when I got to the lady, she said, asked me if I had money. And I told her no. Well, she said, "Can you get money from home?" I said, "Yes, but I don't like to." "No," she says, "you'd have to have money." So I gave her 3 addresses. And she says, "You come here tomorrow morning." And she went with me to the telegraph office. And I gave her the address and so. Just
how old were you, Louis?
What?
How old were you?
15. And they gave her the and she sent a telegram. And 2 days later, some money came in. Every aunt and uncle that I know got a telegram. Well, I finally, it was ten, not about 5 or 6. They didn't send a hell of a lot anyhow. But it helped. I paid her for a couple of days, and in the meantime I found out where all the sailors and the seamen hang out. And that was on the Lemon Street in London. And that was on the Lemon Street. And there was an international seaman's home. That's where I went. Because the money didn't last long there. But in the meantime, it was a kind of a semi-religious outfit too. So they let me stay. And in the meantime, I got acquainted with 4 or 5 more of young fellas like me, all Germans. And they had a scheme. They were smart little devils. They wrote nice letters. One of them was very good, a begging letter. And then they go to the library and pick out all the wealthy Germans. And then they go and hand them a letter. And I got in with them. Oh, hell, there was days I made 15, 20 shillings. So then we would sit, we were living in the seaman's home. And we had they had a bar there too. And we had there was a round table, we appropriated that. There'd be 6, 7, or 8 of us. And we'd sit there and count what money I made. We made bacon and told us our relations, what we've been doing and where and when. And before I came to London, I also had run away to Paris first. And my sister, she was a governess with a French family, and they had 2 grown-up children about my age. And I stayed with them for a couple of days, but like a woman, she wrote home, told them that I was there. And that was before I went to London. And they notified the police. And one morning, a policeman come to the door, asked for me. And sister then told me you'd have to go with him. They put me on the train to go back home. And when I got back to Germany, they turned me loose on the border. And my sister had given me some money. And I went to Cologne, that's where we were living. And instead of go home, I went right down to the Rhine.
Louis, were your parents in Cologne?
Yeah.
Is that where you were born?
No, I was raised near Koblenz. And that's up the river from there, up the Rhine. So, I went to...
Let me ask you, you were born in about, what, 1887?
What?
Were you born in 1887, was it?
1886.
1886. When were you born in 1886? When's your birthday?
April the 17th. An April Fool.
Well, hurry up and then and tell me how you got to Alaska.
What?
Go on and hurry up and tell me how you...
That's a long story.
Well, I want to hear about Alaska.
Hell, I went to Africa first and to the Black Sea and Russia and Turkey and them countries. But when I went to Alaska, I stowed away from Liverpool in England to Halifax, Nova Scotia, on one of the big liners. Got to Halifax, and they kicked me off there, which I wanted anyhow. And then I got worked in Halifax 6 months. I got a job there in a bakery. And
Had you worked in a bakery before that?
Yeah, I was an apprentice in Germany. And I never finished, of course. I went away. But what little I learned, it came, stood me good. So I went, I worked there in the bakery, and then I beat my way on trains until I got down to Chicago. And I got the job there right away, and I must have been there at least two years, 1904 I left. Then I went Holborn for a year and a half. I made my way to San Francisco on Pullman side doors, freight trains. And from there I came up to Alaska.
Why did you decide to come to Alaska?
In San Francisco.
Why, yeah?
Oh, I've seen so many fellas I got acquainted with that was down during the gold rush. And the papers was full of it. So I said, I'm going to Alaska. And I got made it too. I went to Juneau on the boat and I worked in Juneau for a while, little odd jobs, and get acquainted.
What boat did you take when you first came up?
There was the Alaska Steamship Line. I finally got the job on one of them, on the Jefferson. I was worked myself up to Chief Baker.
Now, when was that?
Oh, let's see. I left home 1902, went to London, and I stayed in England and worked on English ships. And it was about 1906 when I got to Frisco. I remember it was the earthquake, right after the earthquake, in 1906, and then in 1907 I went up to Seattle, and I worked in Seattle for a while, and then I got the job on the boats, on the boats running up and down the coast. I've been on a number of them, mess boy or whatever I could get. Then in 1912 I made my way into Whitehorse, into Canada. They were still working on the railroad to from Skagway up to
Whitehorse. Whitehorse. The White Pass Yukon Railway.
Yeah. And I went there, and then I met a young fella and we built a boat and drifted down to Yukon.
Tell me, Louis, when you did you take the train from Skagway? Or did you work on the railroad there?
No, we paid our way.
I see. Now, were people...
It wasn't much.
Uh-huh. Was anybody... were they still going over the Chilkoot Trail at that time?
No. Not but when the railroad was finished, they quit that. Well, then we built a boat and we drifted down to Yukon. We got as far as Fort Yukon. The fella was with me. He was dumb, and he couldn't handle a boat, he couldn't do nothing. So I left him in Fort Yukon. I told him, you get out of here, I'm going on alone. And all I had, a dog and a young owl.
An owl?
A bird. That owl was a better watchman than the dog.
Now, where did you get the owl?
I got it from some kids.
Where?
Indian kids along the river, in the Indian village below Yukon, Fort Yukon. And I gave him some money, and I gave him some food I had and candies. They gave me the owl. And I had the owl sitting on the stern and the dog in the boat, and that owl was a better watchman than the dog. When the steamboat was way off, I used to drift down. I'd had a gunny sack full of rocks hanging over the bow that kept me in the stream. And then drifting, I went to sleep. And when the owls saw us notice a steamboat coming, either way, down or up, and she'd start to jump and hoot up and down, hoo, 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 and I'd wake up. And that gave me a chance to get out of the way from the boat. But the dog, he would sleep. And I went on until I got down to Holy Cross. Took me about 4 months. I bumped all my way whenever I got, they had those U.S. station all along the Yukon. And they were manned by soldiers. And I'd go in with I had a half a dollar. And I'd visit them, talk for a while, boys, can you let me have about 50 cents worth of rice? Oh, sure, and they'd give me maybe 2-3 pounds or more. Oh, keep the money. In the next place I come, I want to buy 50 cents worth of coffee or sugar, whatever I needed. And then they always said, oh, keep the money. And after 4 months I got down to Holy Cross, I still had that half a dollar and had about 4 or 5 days grub in my boat. Of course, on the way down, I helped myself to fish from the fish wheels. I just go alongside and take a good new fish and throw the others back in the box, what I had in the water, and or fed the dog with that. And then I, in one Indian village, they had no fish wheel there, that I gave them some 3-4 fish I had, nice fish, salmon, and they gave me meat, moose meat. And then I used to go ashore and stay a couple of hours or an empty cabin and cook the meat and make coffee and stay a day or two and go on again. But I made it. By fall I was in Holy Cross. Then I got acquainted with a German trader. He took me up to the Iditarod, up the Iditarod River into Flat. And I stayed there 4 years. That was the finest 4 years I ever spent in Alaska. I was working and made good money. I made board and room and $7 a day. And I worked all the time, and gee, I had a good time. Spent every dollar too. I was there 4 years, and then the war came on. Then they sent me out to join the report. They sent me to Washington. Then they found out I had been in the Navy. Then they sent me to Bremerton. And they turned me down for service because my feet got on the bum then from all this train catching and jumping. Both of my instep were broken down. Then they gave me a job. They gave me a job on the boat as an instructor. Gave me a petty officer's uniform, and then the war stopped. And then I come back to Alaska. Been here ever since. Oh, I left 3 times afterwards just to make a trip around the world and come back. I made 4 trips around the world on the dollar line and then always come back to Alaska.
Where did you go when you came back from Bremerton? Or during the war, you were in Bremerton then, in 1918?
I was in Bremerton most of the time, and then I was they put me on a boat on the Iroquois as an instructor. It was a school ship. And we went to San Francisco up and down.
Okay, then you got out of the service in about 1918.
I didn't have to go into service.
Oh, I see. Of course, you were...
Instead of going into service, they put me on that school ship as an instructor.
Well...
And all the battles I fought in that war was up on Pike Street in Seattle.
Okay, but when the war was over, I didn't really mean in the service, but anyway, when you stopped working on the ship and came back to Alaska, where did you go then? Did you go back to Flat?
No, I went to Fairbanks.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Oh, I've been in Fairbanks ever since.
Oh.
except when I went out and make a trip around the world and come back. I've done that 4 times.
Well, what did you do here in Fairbanks?
I worked in the bakeries. You know where the Mecca is now? There used to be the Tallinna Bakery. I was running that. The boss was no baker. I learned to work and run it, too.
Well, now, how about out in the mining camps? Did you ever get out in the mining
camps? Yes, sure. I've been in mining camps and worked in the cooking in camps and baked. And then I was, in the winter, I was trapping out in the Kantishna.
The Kantishna?
Yeah.
You did? When did you trap out in the Kantishna?
Well, 2 years. I was out there in... God damn it. Wait a minute, where did it go? 15, 7.
See, the war would have been over about 1917 or 18.
Oh, that war was over long.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yes, the war was over long then. I'm just trying to figure out just about what year it was. God, the years went so fast.
They sure do, don't they? Well, when you came back to Fairbanks, where did you go to work right away then?
Well, in Fairbanks I worked in the mortar for a couple of years. But then I went out to the conditioner. I stayed there and done some trapping, and that's where I had the experience with wolves and bears. With the bears, that experience I had down in the Iditarod.
Now, which experience was that?
Well, we had a wood contract to go out and cut wood in the head of Otter Creek.
Who's we?
A partner and me.
Who was that?
Oh, he left Alaska years ago. Name was Billy Bristol. But we went up there to estimate the cord of timber, the head of otter. And it was a nice, what you call an Indian summer day in October. And we went up Otter Creek, walked along the mountain ridge, and then on Otter Creek, we followed the hill, and then little side streams coming out. We get to a side stream, one of us would lay down to sleep, and the other one go up and estimate and come back, and then we go to the next creek, and then he lay down and rest. So that was a nice warm day, Indian summer day, and I was laying right close to a berry patch. And there was a my partner, he went up, but when he come back, instead of come to me, he stood away about 60 feet or so. He carried a rifle, but when he come back, I was sound asleep. There were 5 bears, a whole bear family right around me. And they were big bears. They Papa bear and mama bear, they weighed about 500-600 pounds apiece. The biggest black bears I've ever seen. And 3 younger ones. So they hollered to me and I woke up. And I looked at him. He stood way off. He says, "Who's your friends?" And I looked around and then I noticed the 5 bears. But I know one thing too. The bears were friendly. They were eating blueberries, and I know if they wanted to be mean, they could have done so while I was asleep. But they hadn't bothered me at all. So I told them, I said, "Don't let them see your rifle and stay where you are." And then I'd sit down on the level, I was sitting up against a clump of willows, and right down on the ground. One of the cubs, she had 3 cubs, one was a yearling, and the other one was old, but in between. But then she had only a cup, too, was only about 5 months old. A little one. And this little stinker, while I was sitting there, he came and played and started to cuff my feet. And then I started to wiggle him. Oh, then he had a ball. He jumped up and down and squealed, and the more I wiggled him, the more better time he had. And the mama bear was right alongside of me. She was watching it. So did the papa bear. But the papa bear, he looked over once in a while. He knowed he wasn't hurting any. So he walked away, and the other pups followed him, except the little one. He wanted to play the hell with the blueberries. And the mama bear, she stood here, watched for a while, right alongside of me. Then finally she paused away. She let out a fear grunt, and the little one run too. But then they were got away about 40, 50 feet, and they were eating there. Big patch of blueberries there. The little stinker was back again. He wanted to play the hell with the blueberries. So I let him play, and then the mama bear looked around. She come halfway and let out a roar. That was for him. Then he run up to him. But in about 20 minutes, he was right back again. But this time I looked around, and the mama bear, she come. She come, they were this way to my left. And she came, and she had a very determined look on her face. But instead of going to him right that way, she came around me and passed me on the right side. Then she stood behind him and reared up on 2 feet and watched him. And oh, he didn't mind, he had a good time. But she figured, now that animal, she was also concerned about me, figuring he would bother me too much. So she held out with a paw and hit him and throwed him like that past me. Then instead to follow him, she come back on the right side and she squatted right up beside of me. I turned a little around to face her like that. And she done a lot of bubbling and soft crunch, telling me about him. Evidently, that's the way to make him mind. And she was very friendly. And then she reached forward like that, and she put her whole face, snoot, into my face. Jeez, it covered my nose, the mouth, and the chin. And I took it, that's a bear kiss. So I have a sense of humor, and kind of a daredevil myself. I figured, hell, I can't make it any worse. So I bent forward and kissed her right on the snoot, too. And when I did so, her whole countenance, her face, changed. And she looked like a happy, kind old lady. And she let go of a few friendly grunts, which I don't know what it meant. And then she got up and she walked a couple of steps and turned around and come back a little back toward me, and some more bubbling, friendly, growling. Not growling, but bubbling, she did. Grunts. And then she looked toward the old bear. Oh, he didn't see nothing, that was all right. But she evidently, when she started to join them, she walked in a dancing gait, as if she was conscious of having put one over on the old bear by kissing a strange bear and getting kissed in return. That animal, and I seemed to understand the whole thing. It was so wonderfully human, her behavior. I laid back and I started laughing. And my partner stood away on needles. He didn't know whether to run or to shoot. And then she went away. And all she done a lot of talking and grunts, but friendly. Yeah, She put one over on the old bed, because before she put her snoot into my face, she took quite a good look at him. But he was busy eating. Human, that behavior of hers was, that's what made me laugh so much. And then when I got up and walked back to my partner, he says, "What the hell were you laughing at?" Then I told him the whole thing. Gee whiz, he says, "Here, I never know when to run or shoot or what I had to do next."
That's an amazing story.
Thank you.
That's amazing, I said. That is an amazing story.
Yeah, but they were so friendly.
Yeah?
Yeah. And here, the wild animal. And I know I have a kind of an ESP, extrasensory perception. And I could perceive she was friendly and concerned about me when she slapped him, when she figured he was overdoing it, bothering me too much.
That's real interesting, isn't it, how animals seem to know.
What?
Animals seem to know how
they
you
seem
feel.
To know, and I can seem to perceive it too. I have what you call extrasensory perception. And another time I'll tell you the wolf story. Up on the Chattanooga is a creek called Flat Creek. And I had done some prospecting there. And this was in March. And on the mail trail, about 2 miles away, where my own trail on Flat Creek entered into the mail trail, I had come that far, and on the creek where I was living, I know there was about 7-8 wolf dens up and down the creek. Well, they didn't seem to bother me. They're neighbors. Wolves are very neighborly that way. I didn't bother them. But when I got to Flat Creek, it was in the evening in March, and the trail wasn't very good. And I had a dog with me and a small sled that I used to for hauling wood, my wood and my water from the creek. And that the camp where I had the base camp was an old barn about 2 miles away. And I had used it to live in, had a stove in there just like in the cabin. So, coming down Flat Creek to the mail trail, and I noticed there was wolves. But they never bothered me before. But anyhow, when I got to the mail trail, I started out, and it was a bad trail, and I had to use snowshoes. And I went along and holding the dog back from, he wanted to run, of course. And I carried a rifle, only 5 shot in it.
Now, did you have the dog on a leash?
What?
Did you?
No, the dog was on hitched up to the sled.
Oh, I see. You were holding the sled back.
I held the sled back, but that trip used to take me a half an hour. But when I noticed all those wolves on the side and behind me, it took me 3.5 hours. I went very slow and holding him back, and carried a rifle, and those wolves running alongside me and behind me.
Why did you go so slow, Louis?
They don't give the wolves a chance to chase. That's why they attack, if you run away from them. Anything that runs, they want to attack it and tear it down. And I went very slow. And not only that, you know, I have a tattoo on my chest, Jesus on the cross. And whenever I was in danger, I always say, "Master, I'm in trouble, please help me." And as soon as I did that, I had no fear. And they can smell if you're afraid too. Oh yes, they can smell it from the footprints. But I had no fear at all. And instead of trying to get there in a half an hour, I went very slow and walked very slow. And they were running along. That had them puzzled too. When I got to the base camp, I opened the door, the dog went in, sled and all, right away. He knew the danger. Then I followed him, and there was a staple lantern, one of the old-fashioned staple lantern. I lit it, and I come out to hang it on the eave, and I looked over, 20 wolves stood out there in the trail. Oh yeah, if that dog had got away from me, I wouldn't be here. They'd run him down and me too. That was a signal for attack. That's why I went so slow and keep holding them back.
How did you know to do that?
What?
How did you know what to do?
Well, I know wolves will, they, when you stand still, they stand still. They'll, but if you run, they're right behind you.
Did anybody you know ever have any similar experiences?
No, no. I know wolves, especially when anything runs, that it's the chasing them. Dogs do the same thing.
When everybody had to go by dog sled here, did other people have trouble with wolves on the trails?
Not that I know. Because
did you ever hear of a wolf pack going after anybody?
They howl, the wolves howl. And the wolves are quite a ways from town anyhow. But when the people that know, when they hear the wolves howl, they don't go out in the dark, after dark. Yeah, I had another experience with wolves. Now those wolves, when I got inside, I stood outside for quite a while and they went over the hills. They were howling for about a couple of hours. They know they missed it. But I come down Wood River one time when I had 7 dogs.
Now, what were you doing up on the Wood River?
Prospecting. I come down Wood River and all afternoon, this was in the spring, I heard the wolves howl. All those side hills. They know me, they noticed me too coming down with that dog team. And it was getting dark and I kept watching for a good camping place on the bank of the river. And finally there was an open space and the river kind of cut in like that and went out again, and there was timber, this spruce, this stunted spruce, about 10 feet thick all along. And so I watched for a good opening, and there was a clearing in the back. And I finally got the dogs through and the sled, then I cut the opening and took all those trees I cut down, and put the sled up against them and made a kind of a barricade. Then I put the tent up. I had a pop tent. I put that up and cut the tree down and cut it into firewood. And then I had to unhitch the dogs and I had them tied in a V shape in front of me so I could cover them all with the rifle. I had 3 rifles and a shotgun and 2 axes. And I had everything ready. Then I had a little camp stove. I put that in the tent and made a little fire and had a pile of wood cut. I'd take one once in a while and put it in. And I had one of those rubber mattresses to lie on. Just let my head stick out of the tent so I could watch the dogs and kept talking to them. And by that time the wolves got out on the riverbank and it was free snow about that high. And they were running up and down the riverbank howling. And all I watched was where I cut through. And I know if they wanted to come through, they'd look up and down. They'd have to make their way through the bush and come down. So, but I could see it from the tent up and down. And the dogs, they just whined and I kept talking to them. And they were out on the riverbank running up and down all night howling. I never know how many there were. But the minute the sun went up in the morning, they all disappeared. And when they run up and down, it was just like a sidewalk. They didn't trust themselves. So they had a candle inside too. They had those big minor candles and thick, they're about that thick, and about a foot long. And I'll have those that candle burning inside a tent. And they're leery about whether it's light. They don't know. Yeah.
Louis, how can you prospect in the when it's still snow on the ground like that?
I look at the rocks and the outcroppings. I don't dip, push the snow. I go out along the river bank and where the snow had been blown off and fallen away, and looking at the outcroppings where the rocks are exposed.
Did you ever do any mining?
I didn't, but I found out a big deposit of asbestos. And I had tried to get several guys, fellas, interested. Oh, they was all they wanted, gold. Now they need asbestos. And there was lots of it.
Where was that?
It's up the Wood River. And there was in some stretches on the Wood River, and there was some of the asbestos stuck right out of the riverbank. I poured a whole bag full of it, put it in the slate, but it was over 15 pounds. I brought it to the college here. And I gave them a little map where to get to it, but nobody ever bothered. All they wanted, gold.
Did you ever find anything else in your prospecting?
Oh, I found copper.
You did?
Yeah, but not enough quantities.
Did you ever get down in that Copper River country?
No. I passed the Copper River country years ago on the boats, but I didn't go up there. All I went up and down the Tanana here and this river here, the Chattanooga. Lots of wolves up the Chattanooga and all the side streams.
Did you ever go up the Koyukuk River?
A little ways. That's below Fort Yukon. I went up there. I think it's below Fort Yukon.
Well, the Koyukuk is down by Nulato, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a porcupine.
I tried to go up there to get over into Canada that way.
That's the porcupine.
What?
I think that's the porcupine.
Yeah, the porcupine country. That's where I wanted to go, but I didn't. I changed my mind. I went down to Beaver and then kept it going down the river.
I see. Well, you've had a real interesting life here.
The what?
You've had a very interesting life. You had a caribou story, I think. You ran into some caribou one time. You were out on a mine.
Well, I rode to a herd of caribou on horseback. And I had to get off.
Now, where were you?
Oh, that was up in the Circle country. And I had my head filled full of rocks. And I also put the dog in front of me on the horse. Otherwise, the caribou would have trampled them. And then I was on horseback and kept throwing rocks at those damn caribou to get out of the way.
How long did it take you to ride through the herd, do you suppose?
Oh, it took me over an hour before I got away from the caribou altogether.
This was up by Circle.
Huh?
That was up by Circle?
There were over 10,000 caribou.
Now, was that up along that ridge, Eagle Summit area?
Yeah.
Where were you going?
I was going to Circle from one of the creeks, Eagle Creek.
Were you baking at the
cooking
there?
No, I was prospecting there. And I went to Circle, went by way of Circle and went out that way too. And gee, those caribou come around, there were over 10,000. For 2-3 days they were passing. When I wanted one, I'd sit right down on my cabin door, and as they come up the creek, and spot a small one, and I'd let them have it. I didn't want to kill a big animal because that's wasting meat. Yeah, but thousands of them.
Did you ever take the riverboats outside?
The what?
Did you ever travel on the riverboats?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was working on them.
Oh, you were?
I was stored on them for 5 years.
You were?
Yeah. I was on the Jacobs, when President Harding came up from Opie up to Nenana.
Were you on the same boat with him?
Yeah.
How about that? How many were on the boat?
Well, that was one of the river boats.
Well, I know, but it was his
special
party.
With about 40 passengers.
Yes. Yeah. Did you meet him personally?
Yes. Well, I had assigned his room for him. Yeah, I was on the steward under Jacobs. They had to, we dolled it up as best as we could. He was a kind of genial, good old gentleman. But he, you know, he told Frank McCafferty, he was traveling around with him while he was in Fairbanks. He told Frank, he says, Frank, I wish I wouldn't have to go back to Washington, D.C. I never felt so good and safe as I do in Alaska. And when they come over the rainy, over the pass, they, all these Secret Service men and his protection was called off. They didn't need him. But he had an inkling what would happen. And he told him, he says, I wish I would never have to go back to Washington, D.C. He says, I'm afraid to go back. He says, something is going to happen there. Why, they got so crooked, they stole right and left. One of them even went to the penitentiary, Senator Fall. Oh, they rocked and the cat was away, the mice did play.
Well, what did the people along the river think about his visit?
Oh, well, he enjoyed every bit of it. And we met, and Nenana, they made him an honorary pioneer, member of the Pioneer Lodge.
And then he went down as far as Ruby?
What?
Did he go to Ruby with you? No.
He was to come, you see what happened, we was to have going to have him on the boat from Nenana. They come up from Nenana, they made a trip down there and come up. And then they were supposed to go on the train to Anchorage. And in Anchorage, there was an army transport to pick him up.
I thought he came up on the train from Anchorage.
And he's supposed to go with us. The original thing was to go over the trail to McCarty on the Richardson Highway. But they didn't come. We went up with the boat and everything, and instead of coming that way, they went by the train, right to the coast. And Harding...
Well, now, wait a minute. Now, you didn't go with Harding on the trip down to Ruby then?
No.
You were on the other boat?
I was steward. He's supposed to come on that boat, but he didn't on our boat.
I see.
And then we had it fixed for him to go to McCarty.
And he didn't do that either?
And they didn't do that. Instead of that, his wife got sick in the hospital in Fairbanks, and they took the train right back down to Cordova.
I see.
That's what happened.
I see. But you were on those riverboats for 4 years.
I was on the river for 5 years.
5 years. Did you ever have any real interesting experiences on the riverboats?
Oh, not much to get excited about it.
You ran, in the spring from breakup and early in June?
Yes, we followed the breakup, the ice down.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Where did you leave from?
Well, you can't go unless the ice starts moving.
Where? Did you leave from Fairbanks or Nenana?
From Nenana. We were working, well, sometimes we come up here too, to Fairbanks.
And who would the passengers be?
Oh, commercial people mostly. Thomas.
How about tourists?
Tourists, well, they generally come later in the summer.
And they were mostly business people on the boats?
Yeah, they come first. They come up here for business. But the tourists, they don't start come till about the latter part of June and July.
I've never talked to anybody very much about those riverboat days, you know, and I think they must have been kind of interesting.
Yeah, they done away with it.
Yeah, it's kind of a pity. Well, then what did you do, go clear to St. Michael's?
No. Some of them did when there was a heavy traffic. They used to go to St. Michael. And also, boats come from Seattle to St. Michael and then go over to Nome. But now there's no more boats at all. They don't go anywhere.
Well, now, Louis, when you took your passengers to Ruby, is that where you ended? Did you just go to Ruby?
Well, Ruby was quite a town then.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, there were quite a few people lived there. Ruby and Tanana. Yeah.
Well, then the people from Fairbanks, or the passengers, they would go that far and get off.
Yeah.
And then your boat would come back up again?
Yeah. There are lots of traffic between those towns in those days. And a lot of fishing, too. They don't put up no more fish, dried dog fish. The NC alone handled over $100,000 worth of business a year with the dried fish alone for dogs. No more dog trails. Nobody keeps dogs anymore. They used to keep all the dogs on the river in the summer and feed them there, farm them out. No more.
Louis, we're about out of tape, but you told me one story one time, and I don't think we have time to get it, but you went through the ice. You said you fell through the ice.
Oh, I went lots of times through the ice.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's kind of cold, I bet.
In two lakes and in a river. I went in the river with the dogs and all, but it wasn't deep there, only about 4 feet. Oh, I got wet. And I know there was a cabin less than a mile away, and I chased the dogs all I could. It was about 40 below, or 30 or 40 below. When I got to the cabin, by gee, everything had started to freeze already, and I made a big fire, took the dogs inside until their hair got dry, and I changed clothes.
Well, that was a close call. Well, we've been talking to Louis Black, and where is this, about the 7th of June? 1974?
Yeah.
So what are you now this year? Gosh, you're something like 88 this year, weren't you, Louis?
The what?
Were you 88 this year?
I'm 88 now.
Yeah, gee, that's wonderful to have all these wonderful experiences to remember.
Yeah, I'm 88 last birthday.
And, you know, I'm like a lot of people. I say I'm glad I've seen Alaska before it was really tough.